I hung on to the idea that he couldn't have gotten everyone, that there had to be others like me who saw what was going on in time to get their heads down. Some would get out. They'd call the state police. I kept telling myself it was wiser, at least for the time being, to wait. Then the storm came, and I decided to try and use it for cover. I'd sneak back to the mining office. There's an ATV in the garage of the hideaway. Steve nodded. We saw it. Got a little cart filled with rock samples behind it. My idea was to unhook the gondola and drive northwest back to Highway 50. I was getting ready to do it when you two came along. She smiled wanly, then looked around once more. And the rest, you know. I don't agree, Johnny Maranville thought. I don't think we know anything. Not yet, anyway. Mary Jackson said, What do we do now? How do we get out of this mess? Do we even try, or do we wait to be rescued? I'm not going without finding out what happened to my mom, David said. Cynthia said, It won't do your mother any good if you and the rest of us die trying to find her, kiddo. On the other hand, if we can get out of town, we can come back with help. Steve turned to Audrey. You said you knew another way out? Yes. The big earthwork, you see, as you come into town, is the north face of the pit we've reopened. There's a road that goes up the side of it, over the top, and into the pit. There's another one that goes back to Highway 50, west of here. Steve, a 10-year veteran of load-ins, load-outs, snap decisions, and rapid getaways, often necessitated by the combination of four-star hotels and rock band assholes, had been following her carefully. Okay, what I suggest is this. We wait until morning, get some rest, maybe even a little sleep. A storm might blow itself out by then, and in daylight we'll be able to see in Trajan. If the storm plays out, we can head up to the embankment in my truck. If the weather's still bad, and I actually hope it will be, I think we should go on foot. We'll attract less attention that way. He might never even know we're gone. He went over to David and squatted beside him. But we'll come back. Hear me, David? We'll come back for your mom and for anyone else he's left alive. That's a rock-solid promise from me to you. David went on staring out over the seats. I don't know what to do, he said. I know I need to ask God to help me straighten out my head, but right now I'm so mad at him that I can't. He let the cop take my mother. Why? Jesus, why? Do you know you did a miracle just a little while ago? Steve thought. He didn't say it. It might only make David's confusion and misery worse. After a moment, Steve got up and stood looking down at the boy, hands shoved deep into his pockets, eyes troubled. The cougar walked slowly down the alley, head lowered, ears flattened. She paused, a low, squalling growl rising from her throat. She didn't like this. One of them was strong, very strong. She could sense that one's force, even through the brick flank of the building, pulsing like a glow. Still, there was no question of disobedience. The outsider, the one from the earth, was in the cougar's head, its will caught in her mind like a fishhook. She would go where the old one sent her. She had no choice. The cougar sniffed the wall, then looked up at the window. She could get inside. It would be easy. The window would push in before her, giving way as man-things sometimes did. No, the voice of the unformed said. You can't. An image flickered briefly in her mind. Shiny things. She understood that she would knock a number of these man-drinkers onto the floor if she tried to jump through the window. She didn't know how that could be, but the voice in her head said it was, and the others would hear them break. The cougar passed beneath the unlatched window like a dark eddy, then came to a second window. This one was at the same height as the one with the man-drinkers inside of it, and made of the same white glass, but it wasn't unlatched. It's the one you'll use, though, the voice in the cougar's head whispered. When I tell you it's time, that's the one you'll use. The cougar lay below the bolted men's room window, curled her tail around her, and waited for the voice of the thing from the pit. When it came, she would move. Until it did, she would lie here and listen to the voice of the wind and smell the bitterness it brought with it, like bad news from another world. Mary watched the old veterinarian take a bottle of whiskey out of the liquor cabinet, almost drop it, then pour himself a drink. "Why don't we save that for later, Tom?" Johnny said, and smoothly plucked the glass of whiskey out of the vet's hand just as he was bringing it to his lips.
"Hey!" Billingsley called, making a swipe at it. "Give me that!"
Johnny put it on top of the bar, where old Tommy wouldn't be able to reach it unless he jumped. He put an arm around Tom and murmured, "Be a good boy now, and you can have that shot later." Tom looked at him with his red-laced eyes.
"Do you promise?"
he whispered back, a conspirator's whisper. "Yes," Johnny said. "I may have been wrong to get you started, but now that I have, I'm going to maintain you. That's all I'll do, though, so have a little dignity, all right?"
Billingsley looked at him, wide eyes full of water.
"I can't," he whispered.
Johnny sighed and closed his eyes for a moment. When he opened them again, Billingsley was staring across the stage at Audrey Weiler.
"Why does she have to wear her damn skirt so short?"
he muttered. "I don't know," he said, smiling what felt like a big false game show host smile and leading Billingsley back toward the others, getting him turned away from the bar and the drink sitting on top of it. "Are you complaining?"
"No," Billingsley said. "No, I just,
He looked nakedly up at Johnny with his wet, drunk's eyes.
What was I talking about?"
"It doesn't matter." A game show host's voice was now coming out of the game show host's grin. "Tell me something. Why do they call that hole in the ground China Pit? I've been wondering about that."
"I imagine Miss Weiler knows more about it than I do,"
Billingsley said. But Audrey was no longer on the stage. Audrey had exited stage right, perhaps looking for something else to eat.
"Oh, come on," Ralph said, unexpectedly conversational. "I bet you've forgotten more local history than that young lady over there ever learned."
"Tell it, old-timer," Cynthia said softly. "Go on." So he did.
"In 1858, outfit called Diablo Mining opened Rattlesnake Number 1, where the China Pit is now. There was gold, a good bit of it. The ground where they sank Rattlesnake Number 1 had a good vein of gold, but mostly it was hornfels, cooked ale. Shale's a sedimentary rock, not strong. You can snap a piece of it in your hands, and when that mine got down 70 feet, and the men could hear the walls groaning and squeaking around them, they decided enough was enough. They just walked out. So what the owners did was hire Chinese. Had them shipped on flatback wagons from Frisco, chained together like convicts. I imagine the owners kicked themselves for not thinking of using them sooner. They'd go as deep as they were told to go, and never mind the sound of the hornfels squeaking and rubbing in the ground all around them. And the shaft could go deeper faster, because it didn't have to be so big. See, they were a lot smaller than the white miners that could be made to work on their knees. Also, any Chinese miner caught with gold-bearing rock on his person could be shot on the spot. And a few were."
"Christ," Johnny said.
"Not much like the old John Wayne movies," Billingsley agreed. "Anyway, they were 150 feet down, almost twice as deep as when the white miners threw down their picks when the cave-in happened. And there are all kind of stories about it. One is that they dug up a Wasin, kind of ancient earth spirit. It tore the mine down. Another is that they made the Tommyknockers mad."
"What are Tommyknockers?" David asked.
"Troublemakers," Johnny said. "The underground version of gremlins."
"Three things," Audrey said from her place at stage right. She was nibbling a pretzel.
"First, you call that sort of mine work a drift, not a shaft. Second, you drive a driftway. You don't sink it. Third, it was a cave-in, pure and simple. No Tommyknockers, no earth spirits."
"Rationalism speaks," Johnny said. "The spirit of the century. Hurrah."
"I wouldn't go 10 feet into that kind of ground," Audrey said. "No sane person would. What's amazing is how long the Tommyknockers protected them from their own idiocy.
When the cave-in finally did happen, it happened in what should have been a good place," Billingsley said. "The roof fell in about 60 feet in from the adit."
He glanced at David. "That's what you call the interest of mine, son. The whistle went off, and the folks from town came up the hill to see what had happened.
I could hear the Chinaman inside, screaming, begging to be dug out before the rest of it came down. Some said they sounded like they were fighting with each other. That squealing sound Hornfels makes when the ground's uneasy was louder than ever. And the roof was bowed down in a couple of places between the adit and the first rockfall. The mining engineers went in, poked their heads in anyway, and said it was too dangerous for any sort of rescue operation.
So what did they do? Mary asked. Billingsley shrugged.
Set dynamite charges at the front of the mine and brought that down too. Shut her up.
Are you saying they deliberately buried 40 people alive? Cynthia asked. How could they do it?
They were Chinese, ma'am, Billingsley said. So it was easy.
The wind gusted. They could hear the faint sound of the window in the ladies' room banging back and forth. Johnny kept waiting for it to yawn wide enough to knock over Billingsley's bottle booby trap.
That's not quite the end of the story, Billingsley said. 3 days later, two young Chinese fellas showed up at the Lady Day, a saloon which stood about where the broken drum is now. Shot 7 men before they were subdued. Killed 2. One of the ones they killed was the mining engineer from Reno who recommended that the shaft be brought down. One of the coolie boys, that's what they were called, was killed himself in the fracas. The one still alive was shot in 5 or 6 places. And that didn't stop him from taking him out and hanging him the next day, though, after a little sawhorse trial in front of a kangaroo court. They had chains on his legs and cuffs on his wrists, and still he followed him like a catamount, raving in his own language all the while.
Billingsley leaned forward a little, seeming to stare at David in particular. The boy looked back at him, eyes wide and fascinated.
All of what he said was in the heathen Chinese. But one idea everyone got was that he and his friend had gotten out of the mine and come to take revenge on those who first put them there and then left them there.
Would it have been possible for a couple of men to have gotten out? Steve asked. No, Audrey said from the doorway. The chances of 2 men ever... It's just a hypothetical case, Mary said soothingly. A way of passing the time, that's all.
Hypothetical bullshit,
Audrey grumbled, and ate another dubious pretzel.
Anyway, that's the story, Billingsley said. Miners buried alive. 2 get out. Both insane by then. They try to take their revenge.
He looked across at Audrey, and on his face was a sly, drunk smile.
You been digging up there, miss. You new folks? Haven't come across any short bones, have you?
You're drunk, Mr. Billingsley, she said coldly.
No, he said. I wish I was, but I ain't. Excuse me, ladies and gents. I get yarning, I get the whizzies. Never damn fails.
He crossed the stage, head down, shoulders slumped, weaving slightly. The shadow which followed him was ironic both in its size and its heroic aspect. They watched him go. Billingsley poked his head into the ladies first and shone his light at the window. The bottles were still in place. The storm, a summer freak the likes of which he had never seen, was winding down. Meantime, he had this problem, this thirst to quench, and it kept his mind off the rest as well. If it had just been danger, someone out of control waving a gun around, that he thought he could have faced, old or not, drunk or not. But this was nothing so cut and dried. The geologist woman kept insisting that it was all in Trajan, but Billingsley knew better, because in Trajan was different now. But how was in Trajan different? He should know. It should be as clear as the nose on his face. But these days, when he drank, everything got swimmy, like he was going senile. He couldn't even remember the name of the geologist woman's horse, the mare with the strained leg.
Yes, I do. It was Sally,
he cried triumphantly, then walked past the boarded-up fire door and pushed his way into the men's room. He shone his flashlight briefly on the wall and the smoke-breathing horse which galloped there. His memory suddenly clarified a little, as if the picture on the wall had somehow opened his mind. Sally. Yes. 1 year ago, give or take.
She called me,
he muttered. Outside the window, The cougar's ears flicked at the sound of his voice. She tensed down a little more on her haunches, waiting for him to move closer to where she was, closer to where her leap would bring her. He had gone out to the riper place, a nice adobe up in the hills, and a fellow from the mine, the black guy who later became the office receptionist, in fact, had taken him to the horse. He said Audrey had just gotten an urgent call and was going to have to fly off to company headquarters in Phoenix. Then, as they walked to the stable, the black fellow had looked over Billingsley's shoulder and said,
"He said, 'There she goes now,' Billingsley said. 'Hi, Aud,'
he'd called and waved. She had waved back. Billingsley had also waved. He had tended her horse, had given the black man a liniment sample to put on. He'd seen her around town plenty since, too. Not to talk to, no, sir, not hardly, but he'd seen her around. In a town this small and this isolated, you saw everybody around. Had to.
"Are you running all this through your dumb head?"
he asked himself. He lined himself up with the potty and pulled out the old hog leg. Boy, he had to go. Drink a pint and piss a quart. Wasn't that what they said?
"Her waving. Hurrying for her car. Headed for the airstrip. Wearing a business suity kind of rig. Sure. Going to see the big boys. Nice leg she had. I'm getting on, but I ain't too old to appreciate a pretty knee. Nice, yes, sir, but..."
And suddenly it all came together in his mind. Not with a click, but with a big, loud kapow. And for a moment, before the cougar uttered her coughing, rising growl, he thought the sound of breaking glass was only in his mind, that it was the sound of inspiration. Then the growl began, quickly rising to a howl that started him urinating in pure fear. He wheeled, spraying a pinwheel of piss, and saw a dark, green-eyed shape splayed out on the tiles. The mountain lion, the flashlight showed it to be an extremely large female, raised her face to his and spat at him, revealing two rows of long, white teeth.
"Oh, my God, no!"
Billingsley whispered, and threw the flashlight past the cougar's right shoulder, missing it intentionally. When the snarling animal snapped its head around to see what had been thrown at it, Billingsley broke for the door. The cougar launched herself at Billingsley, front paws splayed, long claws out. Her big paws snagged in the waist pants and held for a moment, pulling the old man, who was screaming himself now, back into the room. She knocked him onto his back and went for his throat. He felt her breath on his cheek, pushing like hot fingers. He looked past her shoulder and saw the horse on the wall, his horse prancing wild and free. Then she lunged forward again, and there was only pain. It filled the world. Cynthia was pouring herself a fresh glass of spring water when the cougar let go its first cry. The plastic bottle slipped from her fingers, hit the floor between her sneakers, and exploded like a balloon water bomb. She turned, saw Steve stare at Marinville, saw Marinville look away, cheeks leaden, lips pressed together, but trembling all the same. Steve looked to Ralph, who nodded, grabbed his gun, and ran toward the stage left opening. Steve caught up with him, and they disappeared that way, running abreast. The old man screamed again, but this time the cry had a gruesome, liquid quality, as if he were trying to gargle and scream at the same time, and it didn't last long. Mary went to Steve's boss and held out the shotgun she had up until then barely let go of. "Take it. Go help them." That got Marinville moving, but slowly, like someone who has been roused from a deep sleep. Cynthia saw Billingsley's rifle leaning against the movie screen and didn't wait for him. She grabbed the gun and sprinted across the stage. "Look out!" Ralph's voice raised in a near scream. "Jesus Christ, Steve!" From the cat there came a kind of spitting roar. There was a thud. Steve yelled, although whether in pain or surprise, she couldn't tell. Then there were two deafening explosions. She ducked instinctively, then turned the corner into the bathroom. Billingsley was crawling, dazed, toward the urinals, his head down so far it was dragging on the tiles. In the middle of the floor, a bizarre waltz was going on. The cougar was up on her hind legs, paws on Steve Ames' shoulders. Blood was pouring down her flanks, but she did not seem to be seriously hurt. One of Ralph's shots must have missed her entirely. Cynthia saw that half of the horse on the wall had been blown to smithereens. "Shoot this fucking thing!" Steve yelled. Now he was out of backing room, In a moment or two, the cougar would push him over. "Shoot it, Ralph! Shoot it!" Ralph raised the rifle, eyes wide, gnawing at his lower lip, and then Cynthia was slammed aside. She turned and saw Marinville stride into the room with the stock of Mary's gun laid against the inside of his right forearm. Cynthia thought she had never seen anyone in her life who looked so terrified, but now that he was in motion, Marinville didn't hesitate. He socked the shotgun's double muzzle against the side of the animal's head. "Push!" he bellowed, and Steve pushed. The cat's head rocked up and away from him. The rider winced, turned his head slightly away, and pulled both triggers. The cougar fell sideways, its head mostly gone, the fur on the back of its neck smoldering. Steve waved his arms for balance. Marinville, dazed, made only a token effort to catch him, and Steve, her nice new friend, went sprawling. "Oh, Christ, I think I shit myself," Marinville said, almost conversationally, and then, "No, I guess it was just the wind and the willows. Steve, you okay?" Cynthia was on her knees beside him. He sat up, looked around dazedly, and winced as she tentatively pressed a finger to one of the blood blossoms on the shoulder of his shirt.
"I think so."
He was trying to get up. Cynthia put an arm around his waist, braced, hauled.
"Thanks, boss."
Mary came in with Marinville's gun, the one that was unloaded, held up by one shoulder. She surveyed the scene and then hurried across the room toward Billingsley.
"Get over here," she said, her voice cracking. "Jesus Christ, oh man, he's bleeding so bad."
The four of them gathered around Mary and Billingsley. She'd gotten him onto his back, and Cynthia winced at what she saw. His lower neck and shoulder had been flayed open. Blood was spilling out in freshets. Yet he was awake, his eyes bright and aware.
"Skirt,"
he whispered hoarsely.
"Skirt."
"I need a compress," Mary said. "Don't just stand there. Help me. He's going to die if we don't stop the bleeding right now." He rolled his eyes toward Mary.
"Too late, doctorin'."
His voice was hoarse.
"Get down here, all of you. Close. And listen to me."
"Let him say what he needs to," Marinville said. "What is it, Tom?"
"Too short for business,"
Billingsley whispered. He was looking up at them, begging them with his eyes to understand. Steve shook his head.
"I'm not getting you."
Billingsley wet his lips.
"Only seen her once before in a dress. That's why it took me too long to figure out what was wrong."
A startled expression had come over Mary's face. "That's right. She said she had a meeting with the comptroller. He comes all the way from Phoenix to hear her report on something important, and she puts on a dress so short she'll be flashing her pants at him every time she crosses her legs?
I don't think so."
Beads of sweat ran down Billingsley's pale, stubbly cheeks like tears.
"Feel so stupid," he wheezed. I did. "Had it. Then got drinking and lost track of it again."
He looked at Mary.
"The dress would have been all right when she put it on. Do you see? Do you understand?"
"What's he talking about?" Ralph asked. "How could it be all right when she put it on and too short for a business meeting later?"
"Taller,"
Billingsley said. He enunciated the word carefully, then began to cough. He turned his head to one side, spat out a mouthful of blood, and the coughing fit eased.
"Mr. Billingsley, do you think she might have caught a milder dose of whatever the cop has?" Mary asked.
He looked at her gratefully and squeezed her hand. Billingsley looked past Mary's shoulder.
Where?
He began coughing again and wasn't able to finish, but he didn't need to. A startled look passed among them, and Cynthia turned around. Audrey wasn't there. Neither was David Carver. The thing which had been Ellen Carver, taller now, still wearing the badge but not the Sam Brown belt, stood on the steps of the municipal building, staring north along the sand-drifted street, past the dancing blinker light. It closed its Ellen eyes, focusing inward at first, but only for a second. It was unpleasant. This body had already begun to fail. It turned its gaze outward, not wanting to think about the blood trickling down this body's thighs, or the way its throat had begun to throb, or the way that, when it scratched Ellen's head,
Large clumps of Ellen's red hair had begun to come away under its nails. It sent its gaze into the theater instead. Mary was still with old Tom. If Ellen could get to her while the others were preoccupied with Audrey and David, it might solve all sorts of problems later on. If it meant to take Mary, there would never be a better time than now. And perhaps while it did that, Audrey would find the boy and kill him. That would be wonderful. No worries then. It could replace Ellen with Mary and pick the rest off at its leisure. Toc went down the steps of the municipal building. Once it reached the far sidewalk, it began to run in long strides, sand spurting up from beneath sneakers which had been sprung out to the sides by feet which were now too big for them. At the top of the stairs, the woman who had been 5'7" on the day Tom Billingsley had first glimpsed her, stopped, looking around. She should have been able to see nothing, but her vision had improved greatly with each kenta she had found or been given. Now she had almost the vision of a cat, and the littered hallway was no mystery to her. Up ahead was an arch with a word written on it in ancient black paint half flaked away. A step or two closer and it came clear. Balcony. Hanging from the top of the arch was a mostly deflated sex doll with blonde Arnell hair, a red-ringed hole of a mouth, and a bald, rudimentary vagina. There was a noose around its neck, the coils dark with age. Also around its neck, hanging against the doll's sagging plastic bosom, was a hand-lettered sign which looked as if it might have been made by a hard-working first grader. "Don't come out here," it read. "Ready to fall down." At the far end of the hall were steps going up into darkness, to the projectionist booth, she assumed. She went to the archway, swept aside the dangling dolly with her forearm, and peered out. The seats had been taken out, making it easy to see the way the balcony floor heaved and twisted. It made her think of a poem she'd read in college, something about a painted ship on a painted ocean. Audrey dropped the arm, which had been holding the half-deflated doll, aside. It swung back and forth, the noose around its neck making a slow rubbing sound. Its hole of a mouth with only one purpose, seemed to leer at her, to laugh at her.
"Look at what you're doing," Frida Fuck Dolly seemed to be saying. "The summa cum laude, whose paper on tectonic plates was published in Geology Review, is chasing after little boys and crumbling all movie theaters. And no ordinary little boy, either. He's special. The way you always assumed you were special. And if you do find him, Aud, what then? He's strong."
She grabbed the hangman's noose and yanked hard, snapping the old rope. The doll landed face down at Audrey's feet, and she drop-kicked it onto the balcony. It floated high, then settled.
"Not stronger than talk," she thought. "Not stronger than the Cantas, either. Never mind the past and the dreams of the past. This is the present, and it's sweet. Sweet to kill, to take, to own."
She looked up the hall toward the stairs. She nodded, her right hand slipping into the pocket of her dress to touch the things that were there, to fondle them against her thigh. He was in the projection booth. There was a big padlock hanging on the door which led into the basement, so where else could he be?
"Him in tow," she whispered, starting forward.
Her eyes were wide, the fingers of her right hand moving ceaselessly in the pocket of her dress. From beneath them came small, stony clicking sounds. David was on his knees, head down, eyes closed, hands pressed together in front of his chin. The dusty linoleum beneath him was lighter than that which surrounded him. It was here that the old projectors, clattery, baking-hot dinosaurs that raised the temperature in here as high as 120 on some summer nights, had stood. To his left were the cutouts through which they had shown their swords of light and projected their larger-than-life shadows. David had come here when the others had run to Billingsley. Even Audrey had gone as far as stage left at first, perhaps to make sure they were all going down the hall, because he had been nearly overwhelmed by a need to pray. He had an idea that this time it would just be a matter of getting to someplace quiet and opening the door. This time God wanted to talk to him, not the other way around, and this was a good place to do it. He began his prayer as he always did, not aloud, but in his mind, sending words out in clear, even pulses of thought.
See in me, God, be in me, and speak in me if you mean to, if it's your will.
And a kind of darkness came down. It was like nothing he had ever known or experienced before. He sagged sideways against the wall between two of the projection cutouts, eyes rolling up to whites, hands falling into his lap. A low, guttural sound came from his throat. It was followed by sleep talk, which perhaps only David's mother could have understood.
Shit, he muttered. The mummy's after us.
Outside the door, which he had shut in order to be alone with his God, approaching footsteps could now be heard. They stopped outside the door. There was a long, listening pause, and then the knob turned. The door opened. Audrey Weiler stood there. Her eyes widened when they happened on the unconscious boy. She came into the foggy little room, closing the door behind her. She dropped to her own knees in front of David, her cold and shaking fingers clasped before her.
"Pray, boy," she said.
"Ugly little pray, boy."
Her voice had changed into something that was neither male nor female. Black shapes had begun to move vaguely beneath the skin of her cheeks and forehead, like the beating membranous wings of small insects.
"Here's what I should have done the first time I saw your toad's face."
Audrey's hands, strong and tanned, chipped here and there with scabs from her work, settled around David Carver's throat. His eyelids fluttered when those hands shut off his windpipe and stopped his breath. But just once. Just once.
"Why'd you stop?" Steve asked.
He stood in the center of the improbable onstage living room. The water Cynthia was dabbing onto the punctures in his shoulders ran down his back in chill streams.
"I thought I saw something," Cynthia spoke in a low voice.
She raised her voice to a shout.
"David! David!"
They were alone on stage. Steve had wanted to help Marinville and Carver look for the kid, but Cynthia had insisted on washing out what she called the holes in your hide first. The two men had disappeared into the lobby.
"What? What'd you see?"
"I don't really know. It was weird. Up on the balcony, for a minute I thought it was, you'll laugh, a floating body."
Suddenly something in him changed.
"I'm not laughing," he said. "Let's go on up there."
He jumped off the stage, stumbled, grabbed a seat in the front row to steady himself, then ran up the center aisle. The boss was just coming out of the box office, Ralph Carver behind him.
"We've been looking out at the street," Johnny said. "The storm is definitely..." "Steve? What's wrong?"
Without answering, Steve looked around, spotted the stairs, and pelted up them. Part of him was amazed at the speed with which this feeling of urgency had grabbed hold. Most of him was just scared.
"David? David, answer if you hear me."
Nothing. A grim, trash-lined hallway leading past what was probably the old balcony and snack bar alcove. Narrow stairs going further up at the far end. He ran for it, Cynthia on his heels. He went up the narrow flight of stairs and was groping for the knob in the dimness when she grabbed the back of his pants to hold him where he was.
"The kid had a pistol. If she's in there with him, she could have it now. Be careful, Steve."
"David!" Carver bawled. "David, are you okay?"
Steve turned the knob and shoved the door hard with his shoulder, expecting to encounter either a lock or some other resistance, but there was none. The door flew open. He flew into the room after it. Across from him, against the wall with the projection slots cut into it, were David and Audrey. David's eyes were half open, but only their bulging whites showed. His hands drummed spastically on the thighs of his jeans. He was making a soft choking sound. Audrey's right hand was clamped around his throat, her thumb buried deep in the soft flesh beneath his jaw on the right, the fingers digging in on the left. Her formerly pretty face was contorted in an expression of hate and rage beyond anything Steve had ever seen in his life. It seemed to have actually darkened her skin somehow. In her left hand, she held the .45 revolver David had used to shoot the coyote. She fired it three times, and then it clicked empty. The two-step drop into the projection booth almost certainly saved Steve at least one more hole in his already perforated hide, and might have saved his life. He fell forward like a man who has misjudged the number of stairs in a flight, and all three bullets went over his head. Audrey voiced an ululating scream of frustration. She threw the empty gun at Steve, who simultaneously ducked and raised one hand to bat it away. Then she turned back to the slumping boy and began to throttle him with both hands again, shaking him viciously back and forth like a doll. David's hands abruptly quit thrumming and simply lay on the legs of his jeans, as limp as dead starfish.
"Scared,"
Billingsley croaked. It was, so far as Mary could tell, the last word he ever managed to say. "Don't be scared, Tom. I'm right here." His eyes shifted from side to side, then came back to her face and seemed to freeze there. "Tom?" Nothing but a gust of wind and a hard rattle of sand from outside. "Tom!" She shook him. His head rolled limply from side to side, but his eyes remained fixed on hers in a way that gave her a chill. She was pretty sure he was dead, but it surely wasn't like it was on TV, when you knew.
"Help!"
The voice, questioning and almost too weak to be heard over the slackening wind, still made Mary jump and cup a hand over her mouth to stifle a cry.
"Is anyone there? Please, help me. I'm hurt."
A woman's voice. Ellen Carver's voice? Christ, was it? She got to her feet, sparing another quick glance at poor Tom Billingsley's contorted face and staring eyes.
"Please,"
the voice outside moaned. It was in the lane that ran behind the theater.
"Ellen?"
she asked, suddenly wishing she could throw her voice like a ventriloquist. It seemed she could trust nothing now, not even a hurt, scared woman.
"Ellen, is that you? Mary!"
Closer now.
"Yes, it's me, Ellen. Is that Mary?"
Mary opened her mouth, then closed it again. That was Ellen Carver out there. She knew it, but...
"Is David all right?"
the woman out there in the dark asked, then swallowed back a sob.
"Please, say that he is."
"So far as I know, yes." Mary walked over to the broken window, skirting the pool of the cougar's blood, and looked out. It was Ellen Carver out there, and she didn't look good. She was slumped over her left arm, which she was holding against her breasts with her right. Mary, with eyes so dark, desperate, they seemed hardly human.
"How did you get away from Intrajan?" Mary asked.
"I didn't. He just died. Bled everywhere and died. He was driving me in his car, taking me up to the mine, I think, when it happened. I walked back to town."
"What happened to your arm?"
"It's broken," Ellen said, hunching over it further. "Can you help me in? I want to see my husband, and I want to see David."
A part of Mary cried out in alarm at the idea, told her that something here did not compute. But when Ellen held up her good arm, and Mary saw the dirt and blood smeared on it, and the way it was trembling with exhaustion, her fundamentally kind heart overruled the wary lizard of instinct living far back in her brain.
"You can't come in this window. There's a lot of broken glass. Go a little further along. Come to his room. That's better. Some boxes to stand on. I'll help you in. Okay?"
"Yes. Thank you, Mary. Thank God I found you."
Ellen gave her a horrible, grimacing smile. Gratitude, shoe-licking humility, and what might have been terror, all mixed together, and then shuffled on, head down, back bent. Mary crossed the hall, listening for any further shouts from the theater. There were none. Then, just as she pushed open the ladies' room door, three gunshots rang out. Muffled shouts followed them, mingled talk and cries. Mary froze in place, pulled in two different directions with equal force. What decided her was the soft sound of weeping from beyond the unlatched ladies' room window.
"Ellen, what is it? What's wrong?"
"I'm stupid, that's all. Stupid. I bumped my bad arm putting up another crate to stand on."
"Hold on, you'll be inside in a jiffy," Mary said.
She set aside the beer bottles Billingsley had put up on the window ledge and was lifting the hinged window, trying to think how best to help Ellen into the room without hurting her further, when she remembered what Billingsley had said about the cop, that he was taller. "Maybe she's got a broken arm," Mary thought coldly. "Maybe she really does. On the other hand..."
hunching over like that was actually a very good way to disguise one's true height, wasn't it? The lizard, which usually kept its place on the back wall of her brain, suddenly leaped forward, chirping in terror. Mary decided to pull back, take a moment or two and think things over. But before she could, her arm was seized by a strong, hot hand. Another one banged open the window, and all of Mary's strength ran out of her like water as she looked into the grinning face staring up at her. It was Ellen's face, but the badge pinned below it, "I see you're an organ donor," belonged to Intragian. It was Intragian, Collie Intragian in Ellen Carver's body. "No!" she screamed, yanking backward, heedless of the pain as Ellen's fingernails punched into her arm and brought blood. "No, let go of me!" "Not until I hear you sing, 'Leaving on a Jet Plane, you cunt,'" the Ellen thing said. And as it yanked Mary forward through the window it was still holding open, blood burst from both of Ellen's nostrils in a gush. "Oh, the dawn is breaking, it's early morn." Mary had a confused sensation of flying toward the board fence on the other side of the lane. "The taxi driver is blowing his horn." She managed to get one blocking arm up, but not enough. She took most of the impact with her forehead and went to her knees, head ringing. "Already I'm so lonesome I could cry." The cop, she couldn't stop thinking of it as the cop, only now wearing a wig and fake breasts, grabbed her by the shoulder, almost tearing one arm off her shirt as it whirled Mary around. "Let go," Mary began, and then the Ellen thing clipped her on the point of the chin, a crisp and elementary blow that put out the lights. It caught Mary under the arms on her way down and pulled her close. "Gosh, I love that song," it said, and slung Mary over her shoulder like a sack of grain. "It turns me all gushy inside. Talk." She disappeared around the corner with her burden. 5 minutes later, Collie Intragian's dusty caprice was once more on its way out to China Pit, headlights cutting through the swirls of sand driven by the dying wind. As it drove past Harvey's small engine repair and the bodega beyond it, a thin blue-white sickle of moon appeared in the sky overhead.